Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. In just a few minutes, we'll give you an orca update. There are those two immediately endangered whales off our coast, and there are controversial ideas to help our local orca population in general. So I hope you can stay tuned for that. First, our top story of the day. It is the first Tuesday of August, which in Washington State means your ballot is due. It's the primary for Washington State legislative seats. There's an open congressional seat, District 8. There's a King County property tax levy and more. So let's say you go to the trouble of filling out your ballot and mailing it in or dropping it off. Will your vote count? Will it be hacked? My guest is the head of elections in this state, Washington Secretary of State Kim Wyman. Welcome, Secretary.
Oh, thank you.
Russian hackers did try to breach our election system in 2016. Will you remind us, what did they try to do?
Well, in 2016, we saw activity where they were trying to get into our voter registration system, but our firewalls held. So it's a lot like someone trying to break into your house or your apartment, you know, trying the doors and windows and the locks hold and they can't get inside. And since 2016, we've done a number of things to beef up our security, both the physical security and the training of our staff that that interact with our registration system.
What were the hackers looking for?
We don't know what they were looking for. We know that there were 21 states that they made attempts on. One state they were able to get into the voter registration system, that was Illinois. And it looks like they were able to download about 500,000 records from that system, but they did not alter any records and they didn't make any changes to the system itself. They just downloaded the data, essentially.
In Washington State, you said it was the voter registration systems they were probing, so not the vote counting system?
That's correct. And that's a really important distinction for people to walk away with, is our tabulation systems, those systems that actually count the ballots and are, you know, tallying up results, are not connected to the internet in any way. They're air-gapped, and in fact, you have to have numbers of levels of security, physical security, to get into them in the first place. So I'm very confident that while Russian hackers tried to get into systems in 2016, they were not able to change any votes or get into any tabulation systems.
Congress set aside some money for states to upgrade their election systems, and you said our security's upgraded. Just basically, what did Washington State do with that money?
Well, we're working real hard. We received about $8 million, and we are working very hard to not only beef up our firewalls and get sensors in place so we can kind of monitor the activity and detect any kind of intrusion, but also doing a lot of training with the county election officials, doing things like tabletop exercises where we say, you know, this happens on election day, what are you going to do? So they can start thinking about plans to respond to an event. And then also working with a number of groups from Homeland Security to the Washington National Guard to do things like testing of our system to see if we have any vulnerabilities and figure out ways to shore those up.
Well, today's primary election doesn't seem like it would be as big a hacking target. How concerned are you? Hello, can you hear me, Secretary? Kim Wyman, Secretary of State.
If you can hear me, I can't hear you.
She can't hear me. Okay. We'll see if we can get her back on. I was about to ask about today's election. She was reminding you what Russian hackers apparently tried to do back in 2016 and telling us about how Washington State spent $8 million or so to try to upgrade our security system. Secretary of State Kim Wyman, can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. Hey. I don't know what happened there. Well,
I think it's very possible that the Russians hacked our phone system during our conversation. Very troubled, and I'll look into that.
Okay.
I was beginning to say that our primary election wouldn't seem like as big a hacking target as a presidential election, but how concerned are you about that this time around?
Well, you know, for us, it's every single day of the week, every single day of the year. You know, we've had people trying to hack into our systems, not just voting systems, I think any governmental system, for years. And, you know, cybersecurity is something that we've worked on for the better part of the last 15 to 20 years. So now we have more tools available to us and more resources because the president designated us as critical infrastructure, which is the same designation the power grid has. So now we can work with Homeland Security and different partners to get more data, more information, and more testing to just take it to the next level.
We are one of three states that do all our voting by mail. Does that affect the security of our elections one way or the other?
I think it actually strengthens our system because we are totally a paper-based voting system. And if anything should happen, we have the paper to go back to. I think one of the things you're seeing nationally is a focus on electronic voting systems where you use touch screens and there is no paper copy made of those votes. They're very hard to defend because you have to go through electronic audit trails to do that. Whereas right now we can pick up a piece of paper and argue about what it says.
So touchscreens and online voting would seem to be the way of the future. Okay. It is in most things, but you're saying there's absolutely no plan to go there in Washington.
Did you guys lose me again?
We've lost her again. Okay. We maybe have time for one more question. Are you there again, Secretary?
I am. Okay. I hope the Russians don't get us this time. Okay.
They are persistent. Okay. So if I may only have one question left, so I'll have to choose wisely. Well, let me ask you this. Here it is, the noon hour, election day. What do you want to say to people listening now? They've got a ballot on their table, in their purse, whatever. It hasn't been filled out or maybe hasn't been turned in. How do you get us to vote?
Well, right now you've got less than 8 hours to get your ballot turned in. And if you're going to put it in the mail, you want to make sure you get it into the mailbox before the last pickup of the day. And probably at this point, the most secure thing you could do is put it in a ballot drop box. Those are open until 8 p.m. and those will assure that your ballot's counted. If you don't have a postmark, it will not be counted tomorrow.
Washington State Secretary of State Kim Wyman here on Primary Election Day. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Again, you've got till 8 p.m. You can use one of those ballot drop boxes or postmark it by 7 o'clock tonight. We're going to be right back with more on the record, an orca update in the case of a couple whales, but also the big picture coming up. You're with The Record on KUOW, and we're live tweeting the show at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The plight of two orca whales has forced their species survival to the top of the news agenda, and the top of the agenda for a governor-led task force that's meeting today in Wenatchee. Those images of the orca known as Tahlequah carrying her decomposing dead calf and her starving 4-year-old family member, these images have some people calling for action to save the orca from extinction. So let's find out what's happening. First with Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes, who's been covering the story and was out with the Lummi Nation yesterday on a feeding practice run. Good to talk with you again, Linda.
Thank you. Good to be back.
First of all, any news, any sightings of these two troubled orcas and their pod today?
No, absolutely not. The west coast of Vancouver Island is completely socked in with fog. The pod has not been seen since last Friday.
And what do we know besides just peering through fog, is there anything we can tell listeners today who really are following this, you know, on Twitter or online or reading your stuff in the Seattle Times that just day by hour they want to know, what can you tell us?
Well, it's a dire situation. I mean, last Friday, biologists said they were concerned she perhaps only had a few days to live. I just posted a story at the SeattleTimes.com website about our conversation this morning with biologists at NOAA Fisheries, saying that they are concerned that by the time the pod shows up, she might not even be there. She may already be passed.
You're talking about the 4-year-old, J50.
I am. Yeah. Yep, talking about J50. This is a young whale, a female whale, who, you know, is just really, really sick. She's so skinny, you can see her cranium. She's possibly got an infection, so there's just a lot of dire concern about her. Now, the mother whale, who was carrying her dead calf for 10 days and counting as of last Thursday, we haven't seen her either. That's Tahlequah, so we don't know if she is still carrying her calf. We just don't know her status. We haven't seen J-Pod. We have seen K&L, but not Jay. And they do this. You know, they go off on their travels following fish, looking for fish, and they may be back by this afternoon. They could be here right now. We just can't see them for the fog, or they may not be back for a while.
And I talked with a researcher last week about how Tahlequah, J35, the mother, appeared to be stressed and maybe wasn't feeding well. So those are both real concerns. I mentioned the Lummi Nation. They're leading an effort to collect some fish for that 4-year-old orca. And this is a bit of a Lummi Nation Natural Resources Enforcement Officer named Aaron Hilaire.
We have the capability of going out, loading up live king salmon, hauling the king salmon to the orcas, and with the help of the biologists, hopefully we can get the right orca to feed and make it all happen.
First of all, Linda, why king salmon? I thought orcas rely on Chinook.
They do. Chinook and king are the same fish, just a different name.
Good call. You were able to go out on a practice run with them as they're trying to feed these king/Chinook. How did that go?
Fantastic. First of all, it was exciting to see these beautiful fish. I mean, it's no secret why they are the monarchs of the sea and why they are the fish that this other monarch depend on. They're big, they're fat, they're gorgeous. There were two of them, at least 15 pounds. These are native Fraser River Chinook, and they're exactly what the southern residents feed on at this time of year. It's what they want. It's what they need. It comprises 99% of their diet in the summer, and they very readily scoop them up out of some reef net gear and transfer them to a tote, which was kept oxygenated for the fish, and did a practice run taking them to a likely spot where the whale would be, and it went smooth as silk. And they're standing by and ready to do this on behalf of this starving whale if they get the call. There are a lot of ifs. Will the whales come back? Is she even in shape to receive this kind of assistance? And all of that is yet to be known.
How do you get close enough to an orca to feed it salmon in a way that the orca will not be stressed out but will be feeding? How's that going to happen?
Well, this is one of the concerns. Obviously, you don't want to make it worse. And NOAA Fisheries, the agency in charge of all this, is very mindful of the need to go gently and go carefully. My own experience of watching researchers working with these whales who have permits that allow them to go closer, whether they need to give them a drug, or they need to sample their breath, or they need to gather their feces, or they need to document them photographically. The whales, they're sovereigns. They're kings of the sea. They're not afraid of people, for better or for worse. They don't run away. It's perfectly possible that this could be done and could go very well, but it all depends on what kind of shape she's in and frankly, if she's even still around to be helped.
Right. Again, in case you just joined us, we haven't seen this this 4-year-old orca for since when? Thursday?
Well, it's interesting. I've heard from Soundwatch, who are the people who are out there all the time on the water, Thursday, and today NOAA says Friday, but either way, last week.
Mm-hmm. Linda Mapes, a Seattle Times environmental reporter, you've been watching these orcas in distress with all of us for now days and days on end. How distressing has this been for you to cover personally?
Well, it's terrible. I mean, these are signature animals of the Salish Sea, and this is an animal that a lot of us cherish and want to see persevere here. And they depend, interestingly, on Chinook salmon, the other monarch of the Salish Sea. And these animals, I think for many people, are signatures of this place. And to the extent that we cannot sustain them, we're not who we say we are. And so it's much bigger than one whale. It's really about this place. And are we going to take care of the waters of the Salish Sea in such a way that these animals can survive? And it's about so many things. It's about toxins. It's about development. It's about shipping. You know, here we are, the Canadian government just approved the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which would times 7 the tanker traffic in the Salish Sea, carrying tar sands oil. So, you ask ourselves, what can we do? Well, in a lot of ways, we're not even doing the most basic things, such as stepping back and taking care of this place and not wrecking more of the habitat that these animals need. I mean, nobody should be surprised to be reading these stories. I personally have been covering the degradation of the habitat of these animals for 20 years. So I'm glad that people are touched by the plight of Talaqua carrying her infant calf. I think one of the most poignant photos for me last week was of her carrying that calf past a giant coal port right over the border in BC. You know, we don't take those pictures as tourists. No, we take them leaping in pristine waters. The fact is, these animals share industrialized waters with us. They share the most populated waters of the Salish Sea. And to the degree they're going to survive, they need fish from even the urban rivers of Puget Sound. You know, it's up to us and the people of Puget Sound. If these animals are going to be saved, they've got to have something to eat.
Are we who we say we are? It's up to us, says Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes. Linda, thanks for the update.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk with somebody who's was at today's governor task force meeting. Again, the Governor Inslee has this task force meeting today in Wenatchee and preparing to make some kind of recommendations, we think, in the fall. It's Dr. Deborah Giles, who was a killer whale research biologist for the UW Center for Conservation Biology, science and research director for the nonprofit Wild Orca. Thank you, Dr. Giles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you want to see from the governor's task force? Let's start with today's meeting.
Well, we're just about halfway through, so we just had some breakout sessions for all of the different, the three main topics, and then within the main topics being, three main topics being contaminants, and then prey quality and quantity, and then vessel presence and associated noise. Within each of those topics, there were, additional subheadings, and so we've just gotten through our breakout sessions reviewing with the task force the recommendations or the possible actions that were filtered up from the working groups. And I sat in on the prey and hatchery, the prey one, and then specifically for hatcheries, predation and harvest. And, it's challenging. There are a lot of interested parties. The most poignant for me was, and it's something that we scientists have been saying for a long time, we killer whale biologists have been saying for a long time, gentleman, and I'm sorry I don't have his name handy, but he was saying that the whales really need to be factored in when fisheries managers are coming up with allocations for what can be taken and what needs to escape up to their natal spawning ground.
Those limitations would be
saying that the whales need to be in that figure, and right now they are not in that figure.
I know that the tribes, Indian tribes, are legally entitled to 50% of the fish. Are tribal representatives mm-hmm. talking about catching less than they're entitled to? Or are we talking about limitations on commercial fishers, sport fishers?
Everything right now is being discussed. Quite a number of different tribal representatives here on the task force, as well as in the three different working groups, which I'm really heartened to see. I'm really happy about that. And right now it's discussions, trying to see what's workable, both for humans and for the whales. And so we're not at the point where it's time to make recommendations to the governor. That will be by November 1st. I can tell you that there are a lot of very exciting possible actions that can be taken. So I'm not in the position. I don't sit on the task force itself. I'm a member, I'm a delegate for the vessel work group and the prey work group. So I'm sitting in right now today as a member of the public to see how our recommendations from the work groups have been filtered up to the task force.
Task force recommend dam removal, which I know is a federal issue, but is that on the table, like realistically on the table?
It's being discussed. I can't say how realistic it is or not. I do know that it is, the governor just this last week mentioned that he wants to make sure that the discussion is at least on the table, which I think is very, very good. Everything needs to be on the table. All possible options need to be on the table right now. One other thing to mention, and I think that it is important, and we that are working in this process need to remember too, is that there are 2 years that the governor has set aside to deal with this issue. And when you're talking about individual animals, it's hard to think in those long terms. So for J50 or for J34, those 2 years seems like a really long time, but from a process perspective, that's good news, because what we can't do this year, we might be able to do next year. And I think that that's something that the public needs to remember. Also, as a scientist, I really want to say to the public that you are welcome at these meetings. You're welcome at the work group meetings, and you're welcome at the task force meetings. And there always is an opportunity, as short as it is, but there's always an opportunity for the public to weigh in and have their voice be known. I want the public to know that.
Doctor, we've talked about solutions, about dams and fishing limits for years and years, and there are so many interests here. There's industry, there's shipping, there's growing, there's fishing, there's irrigation, there's just so many obstacles. It's not like snap a finger, save the orcas. So how big a difference, if any, do you think these latest attention-getting, heartbreaking stories of these two orcas, how much does that change that discussion?
Oh, I think it's huge. I think it has added a sense of urgency to the work groups and to the task force. What we've seen in the past 2 weeks with these whales has made it real. It's not just a thought exercise anymore. I think that the press that this has gotten has advanced this discussion by leaps and bounds. I cannot stress that enough. Linda Mapes' coverage in the Seattle Times has been phenomenal. Allison Morrow, just everybody, KUOW, you guys have been doing some fantastic reporting on this. And the more you guys do that, the more the public becomes engaged, and that's what we need to see. And it filters up and creates that sense of urgency to do something bold.
Final question, Doctor. How long do you think we have before these southern resident orcas go extinct?
People keep asking me that question, and I don't have an answer to that because it's really about which members we might potentially lose. If we lose many more breeding age females, the population is functionally extinct. We have to have breeding age females. And right now with J35 having carried her calf around, her dead calf around for 10 plus days, that's not good news for her. And if we lose her, that would be a really big blow to this population. And we need recruitment. We need the whales to be having their babies, getting pregnant and having viable babies. And right now, they're too food deprived to have that happen. We know that from Dr. Sam Wasser's fecal studies. So if the food is the biggest issue right now. We need to figure out a way to get more fish in the water for the whales to find, leave more fish in the water for the whales to find, and then tackle all of the other big issues that are threats to both the whales and to us, because we're not just talking about whales here. We're talking about the people of Puget Sound and the people of the world.
Dr. Deborah Giles is a killer whale research biologist and orca research biologist for the University of Washington Center for Conservation Biology and science and research director for the nonprofit Wild Orca. And she is at that governor's task force meeting in Wenatchee right now, this ongoing meeting. Doctor, we'll let you get back to it. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for your coverage.
We're going to take you up as the record continues, up, up into the Space Needle. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW, again, live tweeting at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. If the idea of looking off a cliff makes you queasy, I don't know about the Space Needle's new facelift for you. We'll talk about this. Last week, the landmark reopened to the public with the world's first rotating glass floor and more. Visitors can watch the world spin a complete rotation every 45 minutes or so. The $100 million renovation includes new floor-to-ceiling glass walls, glass benches. I saw a photo of you sitting on one of those glass benches looking precarious, Knute Berger.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Crosscut columnist Knute Berger wrote the book, Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. He's, of course, been up in the renovated Needle. And one of the designers of the Needle's new look is Alan Maskin, owner and principal architect at Olson Kundig. Am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Alan, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much.
First, Knute, new Space Needle, better or worse, and how much?
Well, I think
a designer sitting right across.
Yeah, no. I think it's better. I mean, it is sort of a thrill for the next 50 years, I think. You know, the intention was to accomplish a lot of different things, one of which was making sure the Space Needle would be healthy, both financially and structurally, for at least another half century or more. So they've accomplished a lot of that. But they've really expanded the ways in which you can see the view. They got rid of the cage that was enclosing the observation deck and replaced it with these glass panes that are canted outward.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually look down now and see the ground. And this rotating glass floor in the restaurant. Of course, the restaurant isn't open, so it's kind of a big open space, and you can walk in and ride on the glass floor.
And it's, ride the glass floor.
Ride the glass floor. Yeah, they call it the loop. The loop is
L-O-U-P-E. Alan, what's the loop a reference to?
The loop is like the sort of little moniker that you would look at to study things. It's sort of widens the aperture. It's like a macrofine glass in some levels.
Yeah, you're expanding the views here.
Exactly. That was the entire design intent, actually, was we took more away, and we took, literally, we peeled away security cages, walls. We even peeled the floor away, and essentially we replaced everything with glass, and there's almost 200% more glass than there was before the project started.
Views are good. Why wasn't it done that way in the first place? Was there something technological that changed?
Well, glass technology has changed considerably in the last half century, so that's one thing that actually happened, and there's a lot of theories about why they didn't do that initially. But halfway through the project, we actually discovered, by looking at Newt's book, and actually we had looked at scans of renderings of the original design intent, and we blew them up on our screen, and we realized in studying them that some of the ideas that we had just come to naturally actually were intended by the original architects. And so they didn't have the technology at the time to achieve what we could. Now, they didn't have a rotating glass floor in any of their imagery, but so the floor-to-ceiling glass that we've added and the expansive views, that was always a huge part of what the original designers wanted to create.
Yeah, well, yeah, they were limited by time and technology. Those big glass panels that, so we found photographs of the original architect's model, and we could see those glass panels were what they had originally intended. But there was a glass shortage in the late 50s and
really?
60s, so they may have had trouble getting the kind of glass. They probably also had some wind resistance issues. I don't think the glass back then would have sustained over time.
Uh-huh.
So they went to a very different thing, and so it was great to be able to see what they wanted to do, and now it was technologically possible.
If I were Fredo Heights, and it was a feat just to get me up into the Space Needle, how am I going to react to the rotating glass floor? How are people reacting?
Well, if you have a profound phobia of heights, you probably never would have gone to the Space Needle anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, there are degrees of that. And what's really been fascinating to watch now that the public is sort of entering the space and engaging with it is the levels with which they can feel comfortable. There are parts that are very much like solid ground, solid floor, you can stay against walls. And there are these different thresholds you can take where you can actually sort of move forward and move into where there's more and more glazing and more sort of excitement, I think. But people are using it differently because I'm noticing families are kind of like challenging each other, like, come on, let's go out on the observation deck, or let's step off this platform and walk on the glass floor. And I think people are finding and discovering, to all of our surprise, that they're genuinely more comfortable than they had imagined originally.
Yeah, I got a kick out of the very first day it was opened to the public. I went up and these like little girls were throwing themselves on the rotating glass floor and like doing what looked like snow angels and then taking selfies of themselves, you know. And it was like the little kids just were thrilled, even while adults were, I think, being a little more timid. I think there's a kind of a generational thing. There's some other things that the glass does that are exciting to me, one of which is some of the glass allows you to actually see into the Space Needle structure. So you can stand there looking down at the legs of the Space Needle, the core, the stairway, and you can see the elevators coming and going. It's really an exciting shot, and the last time anybody really had that view was when the iron workers were building the Space Needle in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is no one misses that glass cage that was put up to keep people from jumping off the Space Needle. And one of the things that the new glass does, it allows you to look down. And we found a lot of photos from the World's Fair in 1962, and a lot of them show people hanging over the pony wall, shooting down, you know, looking down. That downward view was something that was really compelling, and you lost that when the cage came on in the 70s.
Alan, there were a bunch of ideas for how could we renovate the Space Needle? What were some terrible ideas?
There were a lot of them. And so we began by trying to think as big as possible, and just we sketched like crazy. And some of the, let's see, what are some of the ones we threw out? We, Olson Kundig is, my firm is really interested in kinetic architecture. So we had these movable skylights that we were going to add to the building, which would have been dead on arrival for our landmarks board, but would have opened it up to the sky, and which we thought would be amazing. We added a glass floor underneath the entire top house, for example, that you could sort of walk on. And while it was a ludicrous idea and would never be approved, it actually began the conversations about what would happen if we actually turned the restaurant rotating floor.
Why was it ludicrous?
To have a glass platform below?
Yeah.
Well, there was a very controversial platform that was added at the 100-foot level. What year would it have
been? Back in the early 80s.
Yeah, that's to this day is still something that many Seattleites don't feel good about. And so the idea of adding yet another platform, and it never would have met any of the sort of landmark designations at
all.
So in that regard, it was kind of off the charts. But it you know, some of these ideas, we had elevators that were going to drop down from the floor that were made of glass that would come back up, so it would return to the way it had always had looked. But at the end of the day, the bad ideas actually can lead to the ones that get built. And the fact that we have the world's first rotating glass floor is a consequence of some thinking that was, out of the gate, wouldn't have passed any muster.
I see. This is a little tape from a newsreel from 1962 at the opening of the World's Fair in Seattle, narrated, by the way, by someone named Peter Roberts.
Dominating everything is the 600-foot Space Needle. Going up it, sky travelers get an all-embracing view of the malls and plazas and fantastic structures of America's first international fair in two decades. From the observation deck, all of Seattle and the Puget Sound region can be seen, waiting to welcome the world to its wonderful party.
That's fantastic newsreel voicing.
I love it.
So you had, Knut, you mentioned at the top that this renovation is going to be a thrill for the next 50 years. Why 50 years?
Well, that's roughly 50 years is when the Space Needle's 100th anniversary is, would say technically. And but I think there was a sense that when the Space Needle was built, it was built not as a temporary structure, as a permanent structure. They designed it after the Eiffel Tower. The idea was, you know, Eiffel Tower was built for a World's Fair in 1889. The Space Needle was the space age Eiffel Tower, and it's going to be a permanent structure. So with a permanent structure, you just have to take care of it. You have to maintain it. The Space Needle is like a ship. It's a metal object that is subject to salt water and rain and everything, and it needs to be maintained. They're going to be repainting it as part of the renovation. They haven't got to that part yet. But they were able to go in and strengthen the structure. They were able to update it. They updated the utilities. They made they redid the kitchen. They redid, you know, all of the systems within the Space Needle. And the idea of the owners is, we want this to be standing 100 years from now, and we want something that's sort of, you know, exciting. And I think people's expectations of things like the Space Needle have changed. With this glass technology, you can go to the Grand Canyon, you can go to the Eiffel Tower, you can go to the building in Chicago, the Sears Tower. They've installed these glass things where people like the thrill of walking out on the glass. So I think the Space Needle felt like this was something that would expand, build on what the Space Needle does best, which is provide views, and do it for a new generation.
Alan, what are we going to build? What are we going to do to the Space Needle in 50 years? Is there something you wish you could do and you want to?
Well, I think that's the beauty of the question, actually, is that somebody else is actually going to be coming along and actually be able to have the same opportunity we had, which is really to imagine what the Space Needle needs to be at that particular time. And so I kind of love that we've set them up, and I'm proud of the fact that we've set them up with a more solid structure that, and one that, you know, can morph and change if it needs to in the future. So. But I probably won't be here to do it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Me neither. So, are the lines any shorter? Are the elevators any quicker? That's my last memory of going up.
So there's time ticketing, which is a sort of innovation that they've started in recent years, where you can actually establish the time you're going to be there, and there's still a small wait, probably 15 minutes, but then you usually get to scoot right up. And there's definitely hours of the day, if you study, and you can study this online, of when you can actually go in where there are less crowds to actually access it.
You know, the people that come are often those cruise ship passengers. I mean, you could see when the cruise ships are in town, people come in the day before. If they're going to make one stop, they go to the Space Needle. because they can kind of take in the vista, they can take in the city, they can identify places that they want to go visit. Afterwards, it's sort of a huge stop. And Eiffel Tower is the same way. I mean, people in Paris don't go there as much as visitors, but you know, people in Paris would defend it to death, you know, but they wouldn't go there for fear of being seen as a tourist or something.
Yes.
But it's a major attraction, I think, for people to get kind of a quick view of what Seattle's all about.
So if I want to avoid some crowds, find out when the cruise ships are coming in.
Yes, it's gonna, go on a non-cruise ship.
Go on a non-cruise ship.
And that's pretty easy. They're pretty regular.
Or go in the early morning or late in the evening and watch the sunset, and you'll be better off.
Sounds like a nice evening. Knute Berger is a columnist at Crosscut and author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Alan Maskin is owner and principal architect at Olsen Kundig. They designed and built the new floor and the new everything.
We did it all, yeah.
Yeah.
We designed it all, yeah, with many, many partners.
It's been a while, maybe, I don't know, 3 to 5 years, and I'm looking forward to
are you good with
taking up my little people. Oh, yeah.
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 I don't know about the kids, but, you know.
I love it.
You're going to get to learn.
We're going to find out. Looking forward to seeing it anew. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
Thank you so much. Thanks
Thank
for having
you,
me.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. How much would you give up for something that may sound exotic or unfamiliar to most people, but it's something you really yearn for, you believe in it?
Everybody felt they were there at the beginning of the great experiment, like we were the chosen people.
Would you give up your money, your home, your family? That clip is from the Netflix series Wild Wild Country, which documents the Rajneeshpuram community in northern Oregon, best known for its leader, the Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh. The documentary tells a story of voter fraud, assassination attempts, and by the way, the biggest bioterror attack on American soil. What it doesn't tell is the story of those the community left behind. And my next guest lost her mother to that cult twice. Her name is Ronit Fineglass Plank. She is a memoirist and co-host of the podcast Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory and the Young Turk show Smart Mouth. Welcome back, Ronit.
Thank you so much for having me.
I remember, you and I were just talking, I sure remember the Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh, and I moved here in the early 80s, but some newcomers and younger folks just aren't going to know what we're talking about. What was the Rajneesh cult?
Well, Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh became really popular in the 70s. He had an ashram in India, and then there seemed to be a big spread among Westerners. He had dynamic meditation and releasing your true essence through living your truest life and sex and meditation groups and therapy, group therapy sessions. And so a lot of Westerners found it very appealing. There was some kind of the free sex and the free love and the releasing all of your possessions aspect, I think, really appealed to Westerners. And so it really took hold out here. And I would say in 1978, it reached my family. And so the ashram basically called my mom, and she went over to Pune. And
the ashram called your mom. Why?
Well, not literally.
Called. She felt called toward
yeah,
it. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. That was confusing.
Okay.
My mom started looking for a group to belong to, and his meditation tapes, Bhagwan's meditation tapes, and his teaching and his books, and the people who followed him were just captivating. I mean, there were ways to get together with groups and meditate and wear the malas, which were the necklaces, with his picture on the end. And I think that sense of belonging is what calls a lot of people who join spiritual movements.
A sense of belonging, but she had you. I mean, she had a family.
Well,
but although the family had kind of split up,
was
that part of it?
You know what I think? I think that I'm not an expert on cults. I'm not an expert in, you know, coercive spiritual movements. But I do think a common thread is finding someone to believe in who says things to you that make sense. People who are of like mind that you can be with all the time and feel accepted. So if your family of origin doesn't give that to you and you might not have a strong faith, how appealing can that be? I mean, we see it over and over again. And so I really do empathize with the people who followed Bhagwan to an extent, even when the ranch was set up in Oregon, in Antelope, because that was the second time my mom left to go to that ranch, soon before it actually broke up. Go on.
What did she say about taking you with her?
Oh, well, so that was put on the table. But a lot of her friends at the time, it was about 1978, told her it would probably be too dangerous to take me and my sister to India with her. They felt, I guess, because of disease or just kind of the confusion over there, it wouldn't be a good idea. And in hindsight, you know, I mean, I'm really sorry that I missed those years with her, those young years with her. Super sorry about that. I also, knowing who I am, know that I would not have done well. I would not want to be a person who was raised on the ashram.
Why do you say that, knowing who I am?
I'm this is interesting because I may be in part this way because of what happened, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to follow a coercive spiritual movement, and I don't follow leaders easily. I'm a pretty circumspect person, but maybe if it had never touched my family, I would be really open that way. But I'm not, and I wouldn't want to be running around unsupervised and have the adults kind of out to lunch being children again and exploring their own passion and lives and not looking after kids. I mean, I think in Oregon and on the ashram in Pune, children were housed separately. There really wasn't organized schooling. The idea of sexual boundaries was really loose. That is the opposite of how I raised my family, my children, and I feel really, really strongly about appropriate boundaries for children.
But what does that do to your relationship? Even though you can see the upsides of not having been raised in that environment, what do you do with your mom? You have some kind of relationship with your mom.
I do. I'm really close with my mom now. And I remember there was a time when, if I'd been in therapy a long time ago when I lived in New York, the therapist wondered where my anger was. Why wasn't I angrier at my mom? And I think part of that is, well, for me anyway, I've always been sort of a pleaser, and I would always take things personally if something didn't go right with someone, and I would blame myself. So that's my MO. So I had that inside of me anyway, but then as most kids might do, you know, you blame yourself anyway. You want your parent to love you. And if they don't love you or show up, you might think there's something you could do to change it. So for me, my mom was the gift parent for so many years. To see her was what I really wanted. I never got angry at her or rejected her. So when other 13-year-olds might be mad at their mom and lashing out, I just wanted her to kind of stay put. I didn't go through that phase. And when I got older and had my children, I definitely had feelings about how she was showing up for them as a grandparent. But ultimately, I never got into a rage, a wrathful kind of backlash about my mom. I'm just grateful that she's here, and I understand that she may not have had the resources she needed back then to be the mom that I would have liked her to have been.
We haven't talked about your father. What was his attitude toward the Bhagwan Sri Rajni and your mom?
Well, I'm sure my father would be so happy to know that you asked about him, because he did raise me and my sister. We went to live with him when I was 7, and we stayed with him basically throughout our childhoods. And he was hesitant to ever let us go visit our mom once we were teenagers, because he was worried about what would happen to us. And it took a long time before he felt like she was stable enough and out of the ashram to have us there for the summer in Seattle. But my father was a really responsible dad. He was a single dad raising 2 daughters when that wasn't so common. And he did a good job of not bad-mouthing my mom in front of us. You know, he was kind of stoic about it. I mean, he certainly had anger and disappointment, and I think it was really hard for all 3 of us. But he did a good job. And I want to say, I think that I'm the way I am, and I'm confident in many regards, and I'm a creative person who believes I can get things done in part because of my father.
I mentioned very briefly some criminal activity. The FBI was involved.
Salmonella.
Yes,
well,
yes.
You did mention the bioterror.
The bioterror, yeah, at the salad bar, right?
How scary, right?
Like, for those who don't know, we should tell people what we're talking about,
bar. Oh, yeah, so Ma'anan Sheila orchestrated a bioterror attack in the town of Antelope and surrounding to try to sicken voters. This is in like 1983 or 1984, to potentially sicken townspeople that would maybe vote against the rights of the ashram. And so I think 751 people ended up in the hospital. They basically spread cups of water that had salmonella infected in it onto salad bars. So that's horrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, that becomes a lot more ominous, right? That's not just a group of people hanging out. I mean, that starts to get a little darker.
Well, why? What forced your mom, or what got your mom to leave the group?
Well, interestingly enough, the summer that she went out to check out what was happening in Oregon, because she was away from the group for a really long time and then discovered it was happening in Oregon again. She went out there the summer right before everything broke down. I mean, so the authorities, the government came and closed in on Bhagwan. He fled. His lead person, Sheila, who is really highlighted in that Wild Wild Country show in a really sensational way, I can add. She left and the ranch was falling apart. And that was around the time my mom left. I mean, she left in November of 1985. There was nothing, you know, everything was falling apart. And I don't know if she would have stayed had things not been falling apart.
Was she totally disillusioned, or did she hold the Bhagwan innocent? Did she pursue him? What did she do with
that? What I've talked to about this with my mom, one of my big takeaways is that when she was there in India, they were not doing that crazy group therapy stuff. They were not doing that wild orgy stuff. And she really went there as a seeker. She was not aware of the bioterrorism. She was not aware of these kinds of these criminal, you know, whatever Sheila was doing. She knew Sheila was a strong woman. She met Sheila. I believe she told me Sheila told her she was beautiful. I mean, she knew Bhagwan. But she was not there for the scandal. She was there to kind of find community. And I think when it broke up and she came back to New York briefly, I think she was lost. I mean, I don't know. It's my own interpretation. But those people, as much as I disagree with the way that they may have left their children, I know what it's like to lose the home you come from. I know what it's like, as so many people do, to see your family break apart. And for those people, those adults who thought they'd found, you know, a utopia, they could not go back anymore. It was gone. And that's heartbreaking. I can empathize with that.
I'm talking, by the way, we're talking about the Rajneesh family or cult. My guest, Ronit Fineglass-Plank, kind of lost her mother twice to the group. Her mother joined them in India and then in Antelope, Oregon. What do you think of this Netflix show?
I wrote two essays about what I think. I wrote one for The Atlantic and The Rumpus because I had such a strong reaction. I'm writing a memoir about this time anyway, but I felt it was really urgent to get my thoughts on paper about this. So many people were being interviewed and writing about this. And wow, I just saw the trailer again to prepare for this interview, and it is so sensational. It's spectacular and exciting, and wow, the music, and you just know you're in for a show. But I remember thinking kind of angrily, like, you know, people are involved here. There are families and children whose, like, lives were broken apart, and I don't know why the documentary didn't cover that. I mean, how do the people who were involved in Waco and who lost loved ones feel about that series? You know, I know we love our stories. I know we love entertainment in this culture. I know we have a voracious appetite for tragedy and spectacle, but it's hard having a connection, you know, to the actual story that occurred.
Why do you think a documentary-based series wouldn't follow the...
I've thought about it a lot. I feel like some people... In fact, Bhagwan's doctor, I read an article in The Cut about him. He said that he wasn't even contacted for interviews. They never contacted him. So they picked and chose who they wanted to talk to, and you necessarily filter out the story that way. And they did not talk to regular people who lost kids or, you know, anyone who lost their families. They just talked to these head honchos, which I think was an oversight.
We just have about a minute left, yeah. Ronit. I just wonder how this familiarity, such a close and at times painful familiarity with your mother's search for something we can all relate to, how do you think that affects how you go forward and search for what's meaningful to you?
I think that I really believe that I know a lot of people need outside help sometimes, but I think that everyone can find what feels good to them and they should listen to themselves. It sounds really kind of, you know, fluffy there, but I really feel like we have to listen to our own instincts and be wary of people who tell us what to think and how to act and how to treat people who we love.
Ronit Fineglass-Plank is co-host of the podcast Mouthy Messy Mandatory, as well as a new show on the Young Turks Network called Smart Mouth. And you're working on a memoir, right?
Yeah, it's almost done. I'm editing it now about this time until I was about 15, just from birth to 15, about this period of my life.
Ronit's life, including her mom's time as a member of the Rajneesh cult. Ronit, we look forward to that. Thanks for coming in and telling us
about it. Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I guess I'm promoting a flawed vehicle here, but if we've made you curious about the Netflix series, it's called Wild Wild Country, and hopefully you'll watch it a little more smartly than you would have a few minutes ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Appreciate you tuning in today. The Record is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media's producer is Kara McDermott. If you voted, get the thing in. Postmark it by 7 o'clock tonight. Use a drop-off ballot box if you want to. We'll sure be talking tomorrow in this show about what happened in our primary election. Hope you can join us.